Americans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I am grateful to the individuals who subscribe to our program, including Eugene Kenny, Lauren Howard, Susan Super, and a new subscriber, Sharon Warden. Thank you, Sharon. Full information is available at peterbcollins.com. Our subscriptions start as low as $1 for a 24-hour pass, $5 for a monthly pass, $50 for a year. And your contributions help support our independent reporting efforts here. In the second half of today's podcast, Dr. Jeff Kay returns. Jeffrey Kay is a psychologist and a journalist. And he has exposed the use of an anti-malarial drug on every individual detained at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. But it isn't to protect them from malaria. It's because of the known psychoactive side effects. But first, the third installment of our series regarding an effort to overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court decision that has allowed millions of corporate dollars to flow into political campaigns. We're seeing it evidenced all over the place this year. Adam Fergatch returns with us today. Carl Mayer is busy in the law office, so working on his next briefs, I suppose. Adam, welcome back.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you. Breaking news to report for you today. We're getting some action. I think, we'll talk about it. I'll introduce our other distinguished guest.
Yes, Rob Hager joins us, who is an attorney whose efforts go back to the 1980s on the Silkwood case. He was one of the attorneys at the Christic Institute taking on the Reagan administration's illegal activities in Central America. He's also been involved in the lawsuits over the dramatic disaster in Bhopal, India, and a Three Mile Island nuclear disaster in Pennsylvania. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Peter.
Now, tell us a little bit about your own motivation here and why you think that this Montana appeal to the Supreme Court, which may be responded to as early as this week, June 14th, offers a chance to significantly undermine the federal Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, initially as to its application in the state of Montana, which has a longstanding ban on corporate participation in political campaigns that goes all the way back 100 years to 1912.
Oh, that's a very good factual predicate right there. You just gave a whole lot of good factual detail. My own motivation simply goes to, I think, like many people who have been involved in politics in America, trying to make a difference, is that the issue of money in politics affects every issue of significance. And so until we solve that issue, in my own opinion, it's not really even worth working on other issues in which the 1% is interested, because they're going to have their finger on the scale in every one of those issues. So we all need to get together and figure out what we're going to do about money in politics and rescuing our democracy from the influence of money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I start. And after this is something I'd worked on, going back to the late 90s. But after Citizens United, I decided to really devote full time to this issue.
Mm-hmm.
We started out with looking at, what would be the best thing you could do to actually rescue federal law from the effect of Citizens United? Because Citizens United was a case that ruled federal law unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And we started to research Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, which allows Congress to strip the Supreme Court of jurisdiction over any area of their jurisdiction, with very few exceptions, which would not cover their decisions on money and politics. And we went a little further than that and found that, in fact, the Supreme Court, when it first took authority to declare what the Constitution means, way back in their seminal case of Marbury versus Madison, at the same time, they said, well, there are certain things called political questions, and our jurisdiction does not extend to political questions. Now, political questions would include, most typically, elections.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started to argue and wrote a long treatise on this, in fact, about how Article 3, Section 2 is the most direct way to get the Supreme Court out of this whole area of law, of telling us how best to conduct our elections. They've distorted our elections so that, you know, plutocrats win and people lose. But now when Montana, the Supreme Court, took this what I consider a very courageous and intelligent decision to distinguish Montana's law, as you described, goes back a century, goes back actually to the era when Teddy Roosevelt had gotten the federal law passed, you know, the original federal law against corporate contributions,
mm-hmm.
That Montana came up with their own just a few years later, that I took a look at that and realized that this is even a more effective strategy, because we can, the first strategy deals with, I'll get a little technical here, and I'm going to mention James Madison, but James Madison, who gets a lot of credit for writing the Constitution, came up with these two defenses against tyranny, as he saw it. They were built into the structure of the Constitution. The Bill of Rights came later. The people who understood the structure of the Constitution felt that the Bill of Rights were actually unnecessary because the structure of the Constitution itself would prevent those kinds of violations that are detailed in the Bill of Rights, which were added as the first 10 amendments. Now, Madison felt that if you could cut sovereignty in half, you could take power and just divide it in half and distribute it to two different governments at the same time, that would be a defense, because those two governments, you'd have a chance to revert to one or the other. If one tried to tyrannize, the other one could defend against it. And mm-hmm. that's what we have in our federal system. That's our states on the one hand, federal government on the other. Then he realized the federal government would be larger, and so they needed to be split up themselves into three. So they split the authority between separation of powers between Congress, executive, and judicial branch. And so we have in the what I described initially there is a problem of separation of powers and how the Constitution resolved the conflicts between, say, Congress and the judiciary. And they gave Congress the trump card, and that's Article 3, Section 2. Now, on federalism, the 11th Amendment is the way that they articulated ultimately. They felt the structure of the Constitution would not allow the Supreme Court to tell states what to do in suits by private parties against states, but when the court immediately, in their first big case, immediately grabbed for power, there was this amazing response. There was a fear that, in fact, it would even break out into a civil war if there weren't a constitutional amendment to put the Supreme Court back in its place, and that's what the 11th Amendment was.
And that goes, this is Adam, that goes to the idea that the elected branches of government have more power than people really think they have, and the idea of judicial supremacy, that the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of all of this, is just really not true. So part of people getting active in getting Congress to act is not just to pass laws, but right now we're going to be moving into an era, at least if Rob Hager and Carl Mayer and Adam Furgatch have anything to say, of listeners and activists actually petition Congress to rein in the court, because the Congress has the power to strip the court of jurisdiction on these rulings if the framers of the Constitution knew that a few appointees could not really speak for the whole country. So it's the elected branches that really have more power if the people ask them to go and claim it.
Now, gentlemen, in the previous episodes here, we have been encouraging our listeners to contact Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer and Montana Attorney General Steve Bullock through their offices. And we will once again post the phone numbers in the show file, link to this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Adam, I understand that there was a response, not necessarily what we were looking for, but some communication from Attorney General Bullock to Attorney Carl Mayer at the end of last week. Do you want to update us?
Sure. But before I do, I'll just say, speaking, I just got an email from one of our team members. Again, our organization is the 11th Amendment Movement, T-E-A-M, team for short.
Mm-hmm.
People can go to the website, and they can really get an idea of how the 11th Amendment relates to this case, Montana claiming their sovereign right to make their own election laws when the court oversteps their bounds. The website is www.11thamendment.org. That's 11th amendment.org.
Got it.
We have many different members from all over the country. One of our members is an attorney. He's been with us almost from the beginning. And he called Montana, I think just this morning, he said. And apparently Governor Schweitzer is a little unclear about what's going on, which I'm going to tell you here, that he doesn't know everything that Steve Bullock is doing or not doing. So call these folks, get them on the 11th Amendment. What we have learned is that Attorney General Bullock's office sent an email to Carl Mayer, who's the lead attorney on one of the briefs for team. We've been trying to get them to comment, why didn't they raise the sovereign immunity? Why didn't they raise jurisdiction and claim their rights? Well, we never got an answer for weeks. We got zero answer. Finally, Carl Mayer wrote, and they replied to him. And in that email, they used the phrase, and Rob can kind of parse it there, can describe, but the phrase indicated that Attorney General Bullock's office knew about the 11th Amendment arguments. They thought that they were strong arguments and potentially a winning argument, but they decided not to raise the argument because of some other, I think the quote here is, implications and contexts that they were afraid of. If they actually won the case using these arguments, that there would be some other thing that they were afraid of. Well, we want to know what other thing could be so important as to not do everything you can to win this case. And we tried to get those answers. Another reporter is on the case in from Washington, D.C., and they are stone cold silent mm-hmm. on it. So,
well, Rob, as the attorney here, why don't you give us some speculation here as to why Attorney General Steve Bullock would say, we know the argument, we consider it a winning argument, but is it a nuclear argument that causes fallout in its usage in ways that produce unintended consequences or, as they say, implications and context? Help us out here.
Sure. Well, let me quote them, because I don't want to misquote them or give a false impression what they did say, because their total explanation is this phrase that they're failing to present this defense to the court because, and I quote, of the potential implications in other contexts if your theories were adopted. So that phrase is the only explanation we've received over a couple months now of working with them, because we started out, I should say, just to roll this back a bit, trying to get them to ask a state, any state, to organize a amicus brief to the Supreme Court. This was our original strategy, because we felt that if we could get a large number of states, particularly states that currently have Republican attorney generals, because this is you have to just say it, this is more of a Republican issue,
right?
That you could pull in the lawyers to whom the five Republican justices on the court, who we know like this issue, have written extensively on this issue and supported more extensive 11th Amendment rights, that they would be persuasive of those judges. And so we worked for a long time. We asked Montana just to pick up the phone and call particular attorney generals who weren't going to do anything unless they're asked to. I mean, this is politics after all. You know, you do favors when asked. And we couldn't get Montana to do that. So then we shifted our request to saying, well, by all means, then at least, you know, raise your defense in your briefs. We'll file the briefs that we had actually written for the state attorney generals to file. We'll file them. You know, this is a long argument. It scans over two briefs. So, you know, there are two organizations here that filed amicus briefs instead, you know, what were intended originally to be state attorney generals amicus briefs, but at least Montana could refer to those briefs now. We've made the argument they don't have to take up any space in their brief. The Supreme Court limits your brief to 9,000 words, and so we, you know, take up just maybe a dozen words at most on just referring to our briefs and making, you know, raising your defense. And they didn't do that. We didn't know that until briefs were filed on the week of the 18th. And so at that point is when we said, okay, now look, we figured out this one other way. And we actually, first we just asked them, would you file a motion? Got no response. And so that's when Carl actually attached to his message a draft motion that we drafted, which we thought would be an effective motion to raise this issue. It's a little tricky legally because they were actually obliged to raise this in their opposition. They didn't.
But they still have the chance, even right now, today, they have the chance to raise this issue in one motion. And the message that, as Rob interprets it, we got a straight out message from the Attorney General's communications officer that says that there will be no further comment on this until the court rules. So that is.
Yeah, in other words, they do not want to discuss this issue with us until it's too late.
Now, Rob, as we discussed in a previous conversation with Carl Mayer, the use of states' rights arguments does have a sordid history. But last time I checked, Jesse Helms, George Wallace, and Strom Thurmond are all dead. And I have to ask, you know, is Montana being respectful of the dark legacy of these arguments, or is there something afoot here that I'm not aware of, where there are other state issues that they're concerned about that could be that the leverage of a state could be eroded by a precedent set in this particular appeal?
Well, that is exactly, that's a big question. That's exactly the debate that we wanted to have with Montana before it was too late, because we think we have answers to all those issues. Just to begin with, you mentioned at the outset, for example, the Karen Silkwood case. People may or may not know that that case was won in the U.S. Supreme Court on a states' rights argument. The question there was, can Oklahoma give a $10 million punitive damages award to Karen Silkwood's family for her death? And we argued that. I personally worked with getting 20 states on board. New York took the lead. Their name is on the brief. I wrote that brief for New York. As I say, we got 20 states to agree. That got the case into the Supreme Court. Once we were in the Supreme Court, we knew we had the votes lined up. We knew we had 5 votes in favor of Karen Silk when we won that case in the Supreme Court in front of a conservative court. And that was like the cause case of its day, that most of the judges hated that type of case, but we won. And then similarly, in a later case, I actually, Agent Orange, it was a challenge to a sellout settlement made by a Brooklyn judge, and we challenged that. And we got, I got, again, personally, with help of some other lawyers who came on board, we got all 50 state attorney generals in the Agent Orange case, called the Ivy case in the U.S. Supreme Court. So this is something I've done in the past. I know it can be done. It's a lot of work, but it's very doable. I consider it on this case to be actually an easy job to do, because you're starting out with you have an attorney general. In the other two cases I described, it was just my case. I was the lawyer. In this one, the attorney generals tend to come to the assistance of other attorney generals. And the 11th Amendment is a pure states' rights play, that there would be no political opposition across the spectrum. So we really were going into this thinking that we would get all 50 state attorney generals to present this argument to the court, and that they would have to listen to it. They would then be in conflict with Congress, the executive branch. George Bush signed the law that they declared unconstitutional in Citizens United. And Barack Obama, we all know, in the State of the Union message, immediately rejected it and asked Congress to do something about it. So they didn't have the support of the other two branches of the United States government, and if we had all 50 state attorney generals, that would totally isolate the Supreme Court. And normally in that situation where they're losing authority, you know, I should mention that with the American people, the latest poll shows that they're only supported by 44%.
Right.
Approval. So that's, yeah. You know, that's what's happening to them. Usually in that situation, historically, they do a turnaround. That's how Roosevelt got them to turn around, basically. They had a fast turnaround in the New Deal, and we thought we could turn them around here with that kind of support. We didn't get that kind of support. So to back to your question now, to move forward into the rest of your question, as I said, it was a big question, that we do feel that there is a way to deal with any of those lingering ideas or thoughts or concerns, worries about, you know, states' rights, as you mentioned, Wallace, the South, racial issues, so forth. But part of the 11th Amendment doctrine is a firm exception for 14th Amendment issues, that Congress can pass any law they want to enforce the 14th Amendment, which is that whole bundle of rights about discrimination by a state. Denial of equal protection or due process by a state. Congress can pass such a law, and they can create a right in an individual to sue a state. In other words, they can abrogate a state's sovereign immunity mm-hmm. under the 14th Amendment. That's perfectly legitimate. The other way to do it is, that, for example, this case the United States has brought against Arizona. That is another way. The United States totally has the power to sue a state for violating the Constitution. But our position in this case is that if the Supreme Court cannot get the support of either Congress on the one hand to pass a law under the 14th Amendment to enforce their Citizens United decision against the states, or the support of the executive branch to bring a suit against Montana mm-hmm. To enforce Citizens United, then the Supreme Court on its own, without support from the elected branches, cannot allow a private individual, which is basically... Since the court controls their docket, it's all, in a sense, it's almost the Supreme Court suing a state, because they allow anybody to come in and, you know, they pretend. In fact, I could go into more detail. I won't right now. But in this particular situation, they are actually defending the rights of all voters nominally. But mm-hmm. I'll get into that later.
Okay.
This is not even the right of an individual corporation. They don't have the right.
Gotcha. Adam.
You were talking to the encyclopedia of how to get money out of politics right here.
That's all right. I find it quite fascinating. He hasn't lost me. Now, Adam, let's turn to the dynamics of this situation. We have this dismissive email from the Attorney General's office to Carl Mayer. I mean, the only thing to be more paternalistic would be some sort of an electronic pat on the head. Now, good boy, sit down, shut up, and we've got this one. And yet, you know, I have not found a reason that there is some can of worms that gets opened up by this procedure that is so dangerous as to cause us to draw back. So how do we try to compel or persuade Steve Bullock that he's wrong and that he should change his mind and he needs to do it really damn fast?
Well, we have our only best guess as to what may actually be going through his mind. Now, whether he's right or wrong, it does seem that an attorney should be doing everything they can to win a case. We can argue about what happens after that, but in their discussions, they must have some compelling reason, but it may not actually be in Montanans' best interest. There may be some other political reasons. Now, that's me saying that. That's not the attorneys in the case saying that, you know, that they're only dealing with the legal issues. But from my perspective, there's a lot of politics around this case. So what can we do? Call Steve Bullock and ask why he is not raising what they seem to think is the winning 11th Amendment argument, and call Governor Schweitzer. As I mentioned a little earlier, apparently it's possible that Governor Schweitzer, even though he knows about our 11th Amendment arguments, he may not exactly know what all the deliberations over at the Attorney General's office have been.
Mm-hmm.
So call Governor Schweitzer. Maybe he needs to get briefed and tell the Attorney General, hey, well, what's going on? So the Attorney General's office is 406-444-2026. 444-2026. And Governor Schweitzer is 444-3111. 444-3111. Same 406 area code. At this point, we're trying to get some reporters to cover the story. We actually have had a few articles put on some blogs. Counterpunch just got posted.
Mm-hmm.
We're working on some of the others. There are reporters now in Montana who know about this, and I've spoken to them, and I think they're going to go ask some questions. So this is all just breaking this morning. It's Monday morning. I don't know when your listeners will be hearing this, pretty soon. So it's Monday morning. Things are moving, but the court could rule on Thursday, so we might get lucky and get some more time, but we're not counting on it. So let's do all we can.
Rob Hager, if I have this correct, you've had some success with amicus briefs in the past, and you described in the Silkwood case how you got attorneys general to support that effort. Have you ever seen a kind of 30-1 here where the amicus brief is not embraced either by the primary party in this appeal, in this case Steve Bullock, the Attorney General of Montana? And what weight, if any, must the court give to an amicus brief on this fundamental issue of jurisdiction? Many amicus briefs are tangential, but this seems to me to strike at the heart of the very first step that the court must take in determining whether it has standing. And this is a delicious irony, because in so many important cases that I care about in recent years, the Obama administration, the Bush administration, government lawyers have been successful in denying standing to plaintiffs in very important cases about torture, wiretapping, et al.
Right. You make a good point, is that amicus briefs can be highly significant or they can be totally ignored. In fact, my last case in the Supreme Court, I did an amicus brief for the U.S. Justice Department, and there was no question from Scalia's first question that he was operating from the amicus brief, and Justice Department felt they gave me permission to file that and asked me to file it because they knew that I could actually win the case as an amicus and that they were going to take a much more laid-back position that probably couldn't win, and we won that case. So I have personally, my last case in the Supreme Court was actually won by amicus. The Silkwood case was won by amicus. We all know that, all the lawyers involved. New York State won that for us by turning that case into a credible states' rights issue away from being a cause, you know, nuclear radiation issue.
Right.
And I have to say, unfortunately, that in Agent Orange, that's a whole longer story, but even 50 attorney generals, which had never been done before, that was the record at that time. No one had ever gotten 50 state attorney generals on a brief before, but that case, I had to conclude at the end, was not winnable.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court does not sit to do justice in huge cases. That would have been the biggest case, tort damages case in history, if the Vietnam vets had a chance to go before juries to put their Agent Orange issues in front of a jury. It would have bankrupted six chemical companies, and the Supreme Court doesn't sit to preside over that kind of damage to corporate America. So I came away from that saying, well, there's some cases you can't win in this court until we change the court. Now, changing the court means changing money in politics, because those, as one professor said, you know, the court has packed itself, you know, by creating a corrupt political system that started in 1976. As Justice Stevens says, every single justice that's been appointed since Powell, way back in the early 70s, has been more conservative than the justice they replaced, and that includes the Obama appointees.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Now, Rob, let me ask you about your level of confidence in the court fundamentally, and I'll just limit my critique here to two issues. There are certainly many more we could raise. But Chief Justice Roberts is an activist of incredible degree. Even though he talked about stare decisis and precedent at his confirmation hearing, in Citizens United, he took a minor case and spun it up into this major decision that unleashes millions of corporate cash into our political campaigns. And we have Justice Clarence Thomas, the silent one in all of the oral arguments, who was a direct beneficiary of the group Citizens United. Right. It was originally, it surfaced in support of his confirmation back in 1992. And he has failed to recuse himself, even with that direct conflict of interest. So given just those two of maybe dozens of factors, how confident can we be that the court will rule on matters of law and not for its own convenience to propel Citizens United forward?
Well, this is a combination of, and that's very good background. I agree with everything you said there. Is that we can't have confidence in these people. You know, they are result oriented, but in this particular situation, this is the most controversial case, I would say, of the last 100 years. In other words, they're under a great deal of pressure on Citizens United, and so what we've given them basically is a way out. In other words, they can, without overturning their decision of just 2 years ago, which nobody thinks they're going to do. You know, that just is not what they're going to do. They're not just going to go back and look at that and say, oh, sorry, we were wrong. Because the swing vote in that, the person usually considered the swing vote is Kennedy. Kennedy wrote that decision.
Right.
Highly unlikely he's going to withdraw from his own decision that he wrote. And so what we've given them with the 11th Amendment is a way out. They can get out of the reaction that the public should have if they impose this on Montana now by simply saying, look, in the case of the states, we don't have the authority according to decisions that we've made in the past on the 11th Amendment, and so we're not overturning, we're not taking back a word of what we said in Citizens United. It simply doesn't apply to the states. So we think that is possible. It would have been far more possible if we had had all 50 state attorney generals. In fact, I was at the point of thinking it was even likely, at least 50-50, you know, if we'd had all those attorney generals. We don't have that. So at this point, we're depending upon those other four judges who are opposed to Citizens United to do what Justice Brennan used to be able to do very effective as a diplomat, is make these judges live up to their previous decisions and apply them even when they don't like them, or call them out as hypocrites when they don't. So we're sort of in the hands of those other four justices and how effective they can be under the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and calling out the hypocrisy of these judges if they don't. The issue of what I think you were subtly raising an issue there, too, is can they look at our amicus briefs even though Montana hasn't raised the issue? And on that one, we feel that's maybe an open question, but it leans towards the answer is no. And that's the assumption we're making of the current judges who have said anything about that. We feel we have to adopt that as a rule that, no, Montana really has to raise the issue. But there are a couple justices on the court now who haven't spoken on the issue, and they might come up with a different view.
Adam, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yes, it is still possible. Justice Ginsburg, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan, and Justice Breyer. I know you're listening out there. I know you're regular listeners to Peter's show. That you might be able to, again, hold these other justices' feet to the fire on what they have clearly established as their position in the past. And Rob and Carl have authored masterful briefs, quoting their own words right back at them. And so, yes, there are so many ways we might get, quote, lucky, but there's an old expression, the harder we work, the luckier we get.
That's right.
And we already had one of those instances several weeks ago when we thought we were up against an April 17th deadline. We were, 22 hours a day at it, and then we got everything done, y'all. We got it, and then we found out that they had extended it for another 3 weeks. So so the harder we work, the luckier we get. And on our end, we are not resting until the court actually says whether they're going to accept this petition or not, whether they're going to accept the case. Because remember, everybody listening, if the court does not accept this Montana case at all, then Montana's law stands,
right.
And Citizens United is essentially reversed. That's the crux of it. Everyone else is arguing, well, if they take it, they're going to vote for or against, and Rob says, well, you know, they're not going to do that. So they can't accept it. Attorney General Bullock has recognized that, in our view, that the arguments we presented are strong enough to keep them from taking the case, and he has refused to put those sovereign issues out there, the immunity issues. We want to know why. Call Attorney General Bullock. Call the governor. Find out why they're speaking that they're standing up for Montana sovereign rights, but they really may not be. So,
now, I should mention, Peter, just following on that, is that the issue is not going to go away for Montana.
In other words,
they may think if we can just stonewall until the 14th, you know, then it's too late. Then they'll come up with some phony excuse that won't matter. But in fact, it's not going to go away. There are certain possibilities there. One thing is the most clear one is the court might take a look at this and say, there's too much here. There's this 11th Amendment. There's this. Let's put this off another week or even further. Some commentators have suggested that might happen, and that might happen. The second possibility is that there's enough brouhaha around this case that they're not going to summarily reverse. That's a possibility. Most commentators think that's the most likely thing they will do. But there's a possibility that they'll think, oh, there's just too much here. Let's set it down for plenary argument. That argument would not take place until probably even after the elections. You know, mm-hmm. It'd certainly be in their next term. And then that gives us months to work on Montana, and we start all over again from scratch, because there is a new set of briefs. There's a new set of amicus briefs if they set this down for hearing. And at that time, we are again, we'll have enough time then. We'll be going for 50 attorney generals on this state's rights argument at that time. So it happens again. And even if they do summarily reverse, there is a case pending right now in Montana U.S. District Court that basically raises the same set of issues, but in federal court rather than state court. And so we've started to ask Montana to raise their defense in district court, and it's not going to go away. We're going to keep on asking them. And then if they end up not doing any of those things, we're going to be putting pressure on Montana and others to go to Congress, because Congress can, by simple legislation, actually reverse the decision of the Supreme Court or deny the Supreme Court jurisdiction to actually take the case.
Mm-hmm.
So we've drafted some legislation there, very simple legislation, not even a half a page, and that's what we'll be working on.
It's not going away, Peter. By the time we get done, Attorney General Bullock and Governor Schweitzer may be closing their eyes, and they're going to see a one emblazoned on the inside of each eyelid. So all they will see is 11.
Well, it's worth mentioning here too is that I'm sure your listeners probably know, but you know, Steve Bullock, current Attorney General of Montana, will be running for governor of Montana this year, and he seems to be running on this case, at least nationally. This has gotten him national attention, and so if he's running on this case, he's extremely vulnerable for not just simply filing a one-page motion that's already been written for them, that the best interpretation we can make of their reason for not filing it is that they think it will win.
That's Attorney Rob Hager, Adam Furgatch. Thank you both for joining us today. We'll talk again very soon and keep the pressure on until we have an outcome here.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you. No pills gonna cure my ill. I got a bad case of loving you.
Dr. Jeffrey Kay returns to our program today. He's a practicing psychologist and in his spare time a journalist who publishes at truthout.org. Jeff Kay, welcome back to our program.
Hi, Peter.
It was in December of 2010 that you first disclosed the use of an anti-malarial drug at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, that is administered to every prisoner who arrives at America's gulag there on the tip of Cuba. And you've advanced the story quite a bit here, and I want to get into it in just a moment. But as we are speaking here on Monday afternoon, the 11th of June, the U.S. Supreme Court has declined to hear the appeals of seven men who are still held at Guantanamo Bay, including one who was essentially the leader of a class of prisoners who are parked there. And his name is Adnan Farham Abdul Latif. He is from Yemen. And there are more than 60 individuals who hail from Yemen who have been cleared for release because they don't have any terrorist activities to require their detention. Yet they are trapped at Guantanamo because of the failed state in Yemen that is the subject of American drone strikes at will. I just wanted to get your thoughts about this latest setback from the United States Supreme Court, Jeff.
Yeah, Peter, I've been thinking about it since I heard about it just a tiny bit ago, and what this amounts to is a de facto reversal, really, of the Supreme Court's Boumediene decision back in 2006, which actually gave the detainees habeas rights. As Andy Worthington and a number of other journalists have been documenting, these rights that they had, on paper anyway, were eviscerated by the D.C. Circuit Court, who was reversing the initial habeas victories that mm-hmm. they were having in the first few years after Boumediene, and just began to find any old reason to say, you can't question what the government says. Hence, that's why all of these appeals to the Supreme Court now, and by the Supreme Court refusing to look at the decisions of the D.C. Circuit Court, which was the only court allowed to look at these habeas appeals in the earlier Boumediene decision by the Supreme Court, really means that de facto now there is no more right of the, you know, that the detainees have. There is nowhere else to turn, and the Obama administration, like the Bush administration before it, has set its foot, you know, kind of drawn a line in the sand to you, me, and everyone else who believes in civil liberties, that they can just do whatever they want, and that's it.
Yeah, it really is stunning, and I'll note that your point is well taken about the D.C. Circuit Court that appears to have exclusive jurisdiction, and the opinion upheld by the court's denial of any further review was written by a Californian, Janice Rogers Brown, who was plucked off our Supreme Court here and moved to the D.C. Circuit late in the second Bush administration. And I've had my eye on her for quite a while. She's a hardline, pro-authority, pro-corporate conservative, and unfortunately, this is very consistent for her.
Yeah. Well, you know, there you have one juror coming from, as you point out, from California. You say she was appointed by Ronald Reagan?
No, by Bush.
By Bush.
It was around 2007.
Oh, by 2007.
Yeah.
You know, once again, California leads the way, but unfortunately not the way that the media says in terms of what's wild and crazy and super progressive, but actually in terms of what is reactionary.
Well, and I would just like to share, I've worked with life prisoners at San Quentin Prison and other facilities here in California, and one of the things that is most difficult for someone who's incarcerated is for the sentence to be unlimited. And so there are a lot of men trapped in the system here in California who were sentenced to what's called a life top. They were supposed to be paroled at some point, but life top has been converted to life without parole. And the hardest thing is to be imprisoned every day and not know when it will end. And for these 60-plus Yemenis at Guantanamo who pose no threat to the United States, they are now consigned to an ugly limbo that can go on indefinitely. And the psychological effect of that is something that I'll ask you about, Jeff, but in talking to various inmates over the years, I know how heavily that weighs on them.
Well, it's a form of torture, really. Physicians for Human Rights, I believe, just last year put out a paper talking about the mental health effects of indefinite detention. And when you take an individual and you put them in the harsh environment of a prison and you tell them, we don't know, or for that matter, solitary confinement, and there's no telling when you'll get out of it, it breaks down a person. You lose, not only are the conditions in and of themselves awful, but it takes away a person's hope, which is one of the worst things, of course, you can do for them. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, causes, as you would expect, a major depression and, you know, even the loss of certain reality testing, if not outright psychosis, in people, you know, who have this, and a form of PTSD as well that comes from this being in this kind of setting. And it's once that happens, you know, I'm sad to say the damage that occurs is usually permanent.
Yeah. And I'll note that the lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, who have championed the cause of the inmates at Guantanamo, are holding a public meeting this Thursday evening in San Francisco regarding the special housing unit, the so-called SHU, at the Pelican Bay Prison here in California, which is where we incarcerate people indefinitely in solitary confinement. And I do think that it clearly qualifies as cruel and unusual punishment. And to the credit of those convicts, they went on a hunger strike last summer to draw attention to this issue. And I applaud CCR for following up and honoring their intentions. I'll probably have a report on that by the end of this week. Jeff, I want to turn to your excellent piece that was published at Truth Out last week. And this is a follow-up to the story that I mentioned you first reported in December of 2010. And what you've been able to do is draw some interesting linkage between the non-medical use of this anti-malarial drug called mefloquine, or Larium is a brand name for it, which is known to have both serious and severe side effects that range into psychosis and sleep deprivation, weird dreams. And what you first reported is that every prisoner is given this drug, whether they have any symptoms or exposure to possible malaria bacteria or virus. I don't even know whether it's a bacteria or a virus. Maybe you do.
Actually, it's neither. It's a parasite.
Ah, okay. Well, thank you. So, recap for our listeners the expansiveness of this program and also who is not subject to it. Because if the effort is to prevent any malaria from developing at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, you would not merely treat the prisoners.
Correct. The Department of Defense has told us, myself and Jason Leopold, who worked with me on these stories at Truth Out, that this was a public health measure, that the detainees were being brought in from Afghanistan, Iraq area, the Middle East, and these were areas of the world where malaria is considered to be endemic, meaning that it's kind of out of control. It's important. A lot of people get it. And that they were afraid that they were bringing these prisoners to Cuba. They claimed the Cuban officials themselves had brought this up originally with the Department of Defense at Guantanamo at weekly meetings or monthly meetings that they have, and that the DOD was simply responding to these concerns, even though there is no malaria currently in Cuba, and even though Guantanamo itself is actually in a very dry, desolate part of Cuba, and not with conditions that weren't amenable to the spread of malaria. Nevertheless, they said this was a public health policy, and all these people would be given presumptive treatment of mefloquine. Now, what that means is you give everybody the treat. You treat them as if they had mefloquine. We don't know. We'll pretend they do. This is a very radical medical intervention, which is not recommended by anybody. And the few times it has been studied, it was thought to be a bad idea. But nevertheless, that's what they did, and this is what they claimed. However, as that at the same time, the DOD authorities were bringing in hundreds of workers from India, the Philippines, other countries that were also malaria endemic. They were employed by Kellogg Brown and Root, KBR, a division at that time of Halliburton, who I'm sure everyone knows, which was association at the time with Dick Cheney.
Sure.
And they were building the new Delta block at Guantanamo, and DOD was so unconcerned that they never checked in to see if these people had malaria or not.
Mm-hmm.
They said, well, that's up to KBR. You know, we're not even going to ask them. So it showed that they were completely unserious about the actual threat of malaria. They instead, it was just one other piece of what I've built, which I consider at this point still an inferential case, in which you put together all these different aspects of what they did, and you come to only one conclusion. This was not the use of a public health measure with a controversial drug, which Mefloquine is, but it was, in fact, a war crime in which they used chemicals to debilitate the detainees and disorient them as part of the process of breaking them down, which was their intention, has been stated on the record in release documents on Guantanamo. And they really, there should be charges and there should be investigations. This is what was done.
Now, I'm about to say something absurd, but I'm trying to depict how absurd this program is. It strikes me that requiring every prisoner who arrives there to take massive doses, these are essentially overdoses of Mefloquine, is like handing out pink fuzzy booties to everyone who arrives saying, we've got to prevent frostbite. Now, there is no potential risk of frostbite whatsoever at Guantanamo, and it appears that the prospects of malaria breaking out there are almost as remote, Jeff.
Well, I don't know if it's as remote. I understand what you're saying. There is an out, you know, there are mosquitoes who can carry the malaria parasite in Cuba. Now, actually, DOD sent out an entomologist. This is something that apparently they regularly do as part of, you know, the DOD is a huge bureaucracy and it has a large medical component to it, and it is very concerned classically with diseases like malaria, but others, yellow fever, et cetera. And they sent their entomologists out there to look at what the danger was in that area, because these kind of dangers are often quite localized. You may not have a problem here, but 30 miles away where there's marshland, there may be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the entomologists, as one Guantanamo medical person wrote in a diary they kept at the time, came back and said there were no what they call vectors, meaning insects in the area that were carriers of malaria.
Uh-huh.
We also know that they used standard anti-malarial sprays, and anti-mosquito sprays and things like this. The danger of malaria and what you would normally do, according to epidemiologists and public health officials, is you would screen, you know, anyone who came down with symptoms. First, you'd see if there was anyone. Well, in fact, there was a real-life experiment, if you will, that happened just a few years earlier when people might remember a number of Haitian refugees in the 1990s fled Haiti.
Yeah, the boat people.
That's right, and they were kept in Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
And malaria was endemic in Haiti, more so than in Afghanistan. And nope, there was no... How did DOD respond? They responded appropriately, at least on a public health aspect. They did not give every Haitian massive doses of Mefloquine or chloroquine, which is another drug, or doxycycline, you know, which is another drug they use against malaria. They didn't give out massive doses to anybody. What they did is they waited to see if people had symptoms, and then they tested them, and then if they had malaria, they treated them. And if it looked like they needed it, they could give out prophylactic doses, which are much lesser doses, of these drugs to people so they wouldn't catch them. And they used other public health measures, such as mosquito netting, et cetera. That's how you handle the possibility of a large-scale outbreak of malaria.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't do any of that. But, as my research has showed, when they went to talk to the Armed Forces Epidemiological Board, which we know from the minutes that were on that you can actually are published online, but no one looks at them. Well, who would? But we can look and see that in 2002, somebody asked, "Well, what are you doing about public health measures at Guantanamo, and what about, say, malaria?" And they said, "Well, here's what we're doing: we're doing netting, we're doing spraying. What about drugs? Oh, yeah, we're giving chloroquine." They lied and they didn't tell the Armed Forces epidemiological personnel what they were really doing. Another red flag that this was a covert operation that was there for some other reason than public health, that they were afraid to admit, even within their own, kind of closed door meetings on medical information. I should say one other thing. A treatment dose of mefloquine is not an overdose of mefloquine. It is they gave them the standard treatment dosage, which was 1,250 milligrams in divided doses in within 24 hours. Normally, for prophylactic reasons, such as for those military personnel sent overseas, quite controversially, the Army would give them mefloquine. You would take one pill a week of 250 milligrams.
Mm-hmm.
But while the treatment dose is five times the amount, and you do get larger negative side effect profile from that, it's not per se an overdose. But when you do give a treatment dose to somebody who you have no reason to believe has the disease, it may not be overdose, but it is malpractice.
Yeah.
And it's, you got to wonder why they're giving someone a drug with potentially dangerous side effects when there was no reason to.
Jeff, in your article, you offer some very interesting history, and I'll take a moment here to mention that we have covered the issues of the MK Ultra and related programs that were conducted by our military and the CIA in the 1950s with Hank Alberelli. H.P. Alberelli Jr. is the author of a powerful book called A Terrible Mistake, and it looks at these programs through the case of Frank Olson, who was a biologist who worked at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and who they claimed committed suicide. And Alberelli establishes in the book that was probably not true. But we're giving away that book to new subscribers here, and I just think the connection is very interesting because it's completely accidental on our part. And if people subscribe to my podcast, Hank Alberelli will sign a copy of his book and send it to you. But you trace the experiments with mefloquine not as a treatment for malaria or a preventive for malaria, but that was explored for its side effects. Talk a little bit about what you learned when you looked into MK Naomi, MK Delta, and related top secret programs of our CIA.
Right. Okay. Real quick on the acronyms. MK Ultra is probably the best known. It was a mind behavioral control program resting largely on use of drugs, but also hypnotism, other methods in which you could control a person's mind or control their behavior. This was a research study. The operationalization of whatever conclusions they had from that was put under another acronym known as MK Delta. And finally, there was another program called MK Naomi. MK Naomi also involved the operational use of research that they were doing on chemical and bacteriological, biological warfare. And it was by the CIA to use as either for lethal agents or for incapacitants, to use to incapacitate people temporarily. That's where I found that they had used anti-malarials. Originally, we discovered, and it wasn't just myself, in fact, someone came to me with this, and both Truthout and the Seton Hall Center of Law and Policy, who also published a study on mefloquine at Guantanamo as part of their law school out there, noted how public documents released on MK Ultra showed that they were researching something called the quinolone family. And what that was the kind of drugs that they were using, a family of drugs like quinine and others that were used against malaria. But that's all we knew. And I just kept digging, saying, well, we think something's there. If we dig, if I think there's oil here, all the geological formations look good. Let's dig and see if we get oil. And what I found was oil. What I found was that the CIA in 1975 was forced to admit, and it was a big scandal at the time, that despite the fact that President Nixon had banned all these kinds of weapons and been told everyone, including the CIA, to destroy them, they, in fact, didn't destroy them all. And a cache of them were found ask the CIA, I don't know, headquarters, wherever they warehouse someplace in the D.C. area, and had been moved from Fort Detrick. And one of the incapacitants that they had listed, they made a listing of everything the CIA illegally had, were supposed to destroy, and one of them was a anti-malaria drug known as cinchonine. And cinchonine is very closely chemically related to mefloquine. They are both drugs that are derived from the original anti-malarial drug, quinine, which comes from the cinchona bark that the Incans had actually used. And anyway, so we found that here they were, in fact, not only researching what these things could do as part of MKUltra, but they had actually discovered a drug that they were going to operationalize and use. They stockpiled it, and you know, the idea was, again, to use it. We don't know if it was used, by the way. There is no documented use of it as an incapacitant, but then they normally don't tell. The only one they would own up to out of the whole scandal back in the 70s was giving a cyanide pill to Gary Powers on his U-2 flight.
Mm-hmm.
Seems unlikely that they spent the millions of dollars on this that we know they did and never actually use it in the field.
Well, and from Hank Albarelli's detailed, exhaustive research, we know that the CIA and the military units that were working on biowarfare routinely tested LSD on unwitting subjects, including at the Veterans Administration. There were programs that included an entire small village in France that was dosed with LSD. So given that as a parallel, it is hard to imagine that, using your term, that these anti-malarials were not operationalized.
Right, absolutely. And when they were told to stop working on them, in one of the MKUltra documents, it was kind of, you could hear them almost sigh, because they had tens of thousands of compounds they still wanted to test. And the testing was not for therapeutic usage. It was for how can we break someone down, how can we control their behavior, how can we incapacitate or even kill them. That's the kind of thing the CIA was interested in. The CIA, by the way, worked with the Special Operations Division of the military at Fort Detrick. In fact, Frank Olson was himself worked for the SOD,
mm-hmm.
Along with people in the CIA. But people should definitely read Hank Albarelli's incredible book. He spent years working on it, and it's just a treasure load of great information on that whole period.
Now, let's run down for people what the known side effects of mefloquine are, because, you know, any off-label use, as it were, has to take into account an intention for the side effects. So
right.
It's been cited for neurological and psychological side effects, including depression, anxiety, panic attacks, confusion, hallucinations, bizarre dreams, and suicidal and homicidal behavior. The effects can be long or short term, and you describe 4 to 5 months is what it takes to clear this drug out of one's system.
Yes.
So this would create a condition where the individual who has been dosed, and we talked about at the beginning, Jeff, just the stress of incarceration on an unlimited basis to begin with. And if you add to that that you have been drugged and you don't know that, and you're having hallucinations and you feel suicidal, these are very potent control factors in an environment like Guantanamo. And your hypothesis is that the intention is to create what is called learned helplessness. Can you describe that for our listeners?
Yes, learned helplessness was the theory that James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who had worked for the Army, the military SEER program,
mm-hmm.
Had picked up from a psychologist by the name of Martin Seligman, who was a researcher in the 1960s looking at this phenomena. What it really is it's the learned helplessness. Learned is in the psychological sense of being conditioned. One is literally being conditioned by the environment you're in to a state of helplessness about being able to do anything to protect yourself or help yourself. So learned doesn't mean like, well, I learned about it in school. It means really conditioned. And it produces a kind of near-total psychological, if not physiological, breakdown because you cannot escape an extreme set of stressors. So if you put somebody in a condition and you tell them no matter what you do, you're going to feel awful. No matter what you do to help yourself, there's nothing you can do to help yourself. A person just begins to psychologically break down. People out there who suffered forms of job burnout or at work maybe have some sense of what I'm talking about, where no matter what you seem to be doing, it doesn't work, it goes bad. And it produces a depression, of course. In fact, learned helplessness is one today considered one of the primary models that psychiatrists use to understand the production of depression in individuals. So these people took the idea of learned helplessness, and they said, how can we produce this in prisoners?
And with a mandate to, quote-unquote, produce intelligence, presumably irrespective of whether the individual actually has any intelligence to cough up, when we go back to the memo that Rumsfeld authorized in 2002, the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, these were all designed to enhance the feeling of helplessness and to give power to the interrogator as somebody who can ease that condition. And the Rumsfeld memo talks about fearing up, using the term fear as a verb, to increase the level of fear somebody has, whether it's done honestly or dishonestly. The manipulation is intended, once again, to control their emotions and, to some extent, their thinking in an effort to get them to tell things that they are holding back on. What is your sense of the value of mefloquine as a truth serum? And I'm talking indirectly. I'm not suggesting that you give it to somebody and they just start babbling. But
right. As
part of this overall process to pry information out of people, how effective would mefloquine be, even in the most sinister dimensions?
Oh, it would never make a good truth serum at all, if there is even a truth serum. The reason being, of course, it debilitates a person's cognitive faculties, impairs their brain function, and creates even states of high anxiety and even in some people psychosis. You're not going to get good info from that. But in fact, these techniques in the learned helplessness and the breakdown of the prisoners was not, in fact, to get intelligence from them. And those who thought it was weren't listening to the trained interrogators who were telling them, no, you're not going to get good results. You might get something once in a while, but you have no idea what you're getting because people are talking sometimes just gibberish or anything just to make it all stop or what they hope will make it stop.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, what they were trying to get were false confessions set up so they could implicate other prisoners, so they could kind of keep the merry-go-round going for the War of Terror, or to set up false linkages such as was done on the Iraq War, where between, say, the Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, which there was no linkage, but by the torture of people like al-Libi and others, they came up with supposed intelligence to make a linkage so they could go to war. Their theory of torture is very simple. It's known within the field as the DDD paradigm, the three Ds, created also by psychologists, I'm ashamed to say. And the Ds stand for debility, dread, and dependency. The idea is through debility, which is to weaken an individual physically and psychologically, by putting them under tremendous fear or dread, which also turns on a certain fight, flight, does things to you physiologically when you're afraid, and affects you psychologically. It produces a state of dependency upon the captor, in which they are in total control, so that you cooperate with them. You cooperate by giving them the information they want, by producing the information they want, true or false, or cooperating in other ways, such as to become an asset for them, an informant, or to act, behave well during a show trial, you know, as they did during the era of the Stalinist show trials way back in the 50s. Well, we have our show trials today, right, where Omar Khadr was put on, you know, in having to stand up and admit that he's a terrorist, the 15-year-old kid, right, who mm-hmm. they shot in the back in Afghanistan.
Yep.
DDD, and so mefloquine is, for the first D, stability. It helps by producing states of disorientation, psychological and physiological derangement. It also, by the way, acts on your center of balance. Causes ataxia and other forms of kind of postural disorientation, nausea, along with the psychological problems. So it creates, it helps, it is a chemical way of breaking somebody down. And some people, of course, will cause hallucinations. It's differential. I believe, personally, that they experimented upon what they would do. They would look at the differential effects upon the prisoners, and some the prisoners who had the worst reactions to it, because some people aren't going to react even to a treatment dose. They'll be just fine. And those people who did not react well, they knew they had a drug they could continue to give them to disorient them. And in fact, later, as my article shows, at least two of the six, or actually it's been seven now, but six of the ones we have autopsy reports of Guantanamo suicides, two of the six showed that they were tested for the presence of mefloquine in their system years, literally 4 or 5 years after they were initially given it. Now, we know that mefloquine washes out of your system totally in about 4 or 5 months. So why were they specially instructed to test them for mefloquine 4 or 5 years later, not months, years? It could only be that they knew that they had been given mefloquine again. It wasn't because of any malarial danger. There was no cases of a malarial breakout at Guantanamo. That, in fact, it was used, they were, you know, either experimenting on its use, or it was used because they already knew that with these individuals, they could reliably use the drug to help break them down.
Wow. Jeff, as you described the three Ds and debility in particular, I am reminded of the heavily advertised and very serious depression treatment drug called Abilify. Maybe there's a big pharma company that has a Debilify that's in the pipeline specifically for DOD and the DDDs.
Maybe. You know, the company, the drug company that was producing mefloquine, Hoffman Roche, stopped producing the drug a few years ago because of all the controversies over its side effect profile.
Well, and if I recall, Roach was the one of the originators of the LSD that Hank Albarelli wrote about.
That's right, yes.
Amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Now, you got a little bit of truthiness out of Captain Albert Shimkus. He served as commander of the Navy Hospital at Guantanamo, and it seems that he was originally a bit forthcoming, and then they reminded him that he shouldn't be forthcoming. And so he kind of moved into ambivalent statements. Tell us a little bit about Shimkus and what he has told you and what he's kind of backed off from.
Right. Well, I'm sure he would say he's never backed off on anything. He's maintained from the beginning, and I think this would be a statement of truth on his part, that he believed that what he... Albert Shimkus, by the way, for those who don't know, is the man who actually signed the standard operating procedure medical orders to give all the detainees mefloquine.
Okay.
And he was also the Surgeon General of JTF-160, which was in charge of the care of the Guantanamo detainees at the time he was there, which was 2002, leaving, I believe, he left in early summer of 2003. And... Captain Shimkus told me that he had checked with all, you know, he was no malarial expert. He didn't pretend to be. He was, in fact, a nurse practitioner. He wasn't a doctor. And he, when he heard that they wanted something to deal with malarial dangers, he called up the CDC. He called up the Navy Environmental Board. He called up, another agency. It just skipped my head for a moment. In any case, the Armed Forces Medical Intelligence Center at Fort Detrick.
Oh, okay.
Interestingly.
Mm-hmm.
And to get recommendations about what he should do. And these agencies got together at Guantanamo. He said he had them come down. They met in Guantanamo in January of 2002, and they decided on the Mifflin Protocol. And yet, when I have checked with all three agencies, they claim that they were not involved in that decision. And FOIA requests that we've gotten back thus far state there were no documents related to such consultations. There's also some question as to what degree the State Department was involved. Shimkus had originally said that they were. He's kind of backed off a little bit on that now. He also told me that he was told not to talk about this, but he wouldn't say by whom. That originally, back in the days that he was at Guantanamo, this was the fact they were doing this was something they shouldn't talk about. But he's backed off in the sense that he pretty much just sticks to the script now. He doesn't come up with, he doesn't say things like, I was told not to talk about it.
Well, and let me read from your article. When Shimkus was asked if he's aware of any detainees who'd suffered psychiatric problems because of drugs administered to them, he said, maybe. That's confidential. And then, no for that.
Literally like that. It was like he was thinking, he responded, you know, what happens is impulse may be to respond truthfully.
Yeah.
And then he catches himself. He literally, it went like that. It went, maybe, oh, that's confidential. No for that. No. I don't know if I do a good imitation of him, but that was the process, how it sounded to me during the telephone interview with him.
Yeah. Now, Jeff, one of the things that I think originally drew you to these issues was your sense as a practicing psychologist of embarrassment and shame that your organization has essentially cooperated with what amount to human experiments at Guantanamo and elsewhere. And you cite in the article a psychiatrist, Colonel Elspeth Cameron Ritchie, that's a female, by the way, and describe her role in these activities, particularly related to the application of the anti-malarial drugs.
Sure. Dr. Ritchie, who's a retired colonel now from the Army, is a psychiatrist. I'm a psychologist, by the way, so we're related fields. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure what exactly her role was with the Mifflin, and she's refused to talk with me about it, except on one occasion a few years ago when she said she couldn't talk, but I was able to get a couple of things out of her, but not much. She was... went to Guantanamo in 2002, and she didn't tell me this. I had to discover this doing, you know, some deep research and data mining, if you will, on the Internet. She went to Guantanamo in 2002, in October, ostensibly to because the Department of Defense was concerned about the suicide attempts by detainees at Guantanamo. And she claims that she implemented some reforms. Interestingly, the number of suicide attempts, according to news accounts, went up the following year. In any case, at the same time, she suddenly was putting herself forward within DOD settings as a Mifflin expert. She had never claimed to be a Mifflin expert before October 2002. She'd never published on Mifflin or even malaria. But here she was appearing at experts meetings as early as January 2003. And then throughout 2003, again in April 2003, at an interagency working group, and delivering a paper on the neuropsychiatric effects of Mifflin. I unfortunately have not been able to talk to her and find out what that was about, what she said at the time. I don't know. What makes this even more interesting, despite the confluence of the fact that she's suddenly putting herself forward as an expert on mefloquine at the time it was now suddenly used by DOD and all the detainees, is that within a matter of, and here I don't have a date because we don't know it, just that she said she did it, is that she also became involved in the training of the behavioral science consultation teams, the BISCITs they're known as.
Mm-hmm.
These were mental health professionals, psychologists and psychiatrists trained to assist interrogations at Guantanamo and other DOD sites from the War on Terror. And they specifically relied on the theories of learned helplessness, you know, the participation by BISCIT personnel in the interrogation of Muhammad al-Qahtani was labeled torture by the Guantanamo Convening Authority for the Military Commissions a few years ago. So here's somebody who is an expert on mefloquine for DOD, went to Guantanamo right around the time at the height of when all the prisoners were coming in 2002 and be given mefloquine, suddenly proclaims herself a mefloquine expert, and then goes off to train the BISCITs in learned helplessness procedures and other kinds of procedures for interrogation of these same detainees. And she remains to this day a supporter of DOD policy. She worked under Kevin Kiley, Surgeon General's office, as a psychiatry consultant. She has worked with some other very interesting individuals I could go into. She's a very suspicious person to me. Other people have spoken, I should say, to be fair, who I respect otherwise, have spoken to me and have said, this is a very good person, this is someone who pushes public policy, PTSD, research, et cetera. But until she can answer these questions about what her involvement really was, I say she remains a very, there's a lot for her to talk about.
And Jeff, you close your article by citing a number of issues that need to be further explored and that you have basically been able to scratch the surface on. Let's go through them here one by one. The mass use of treatment levels of mefloquine at Guantanamo was unprecedented. I think that goes unchallenged.
Yeah, these were all actually things that are, I feel, have been proven.
Uh-huh. Okay, then I'll recant what I just said. but they're interesting summary points.
Yes.
The drug was limited to only one group of potential malaria carriers, and I think that is a violation of epidemiological protocols, right?
Yes, other people from similar areas were not given this, and they and certainly if they were really afraid, they didn't. They could have given American military personnel and civilian personnel at Guantanamo prophylactic doses of anti-malarial drugs if they really felt malaria could break out. But nobody else was given any form of malaria drug treatment or prophylactic at Guantanamo at all, period.
You cite the use of mefloquine for presumptive treatment continuing for years past the point when the Department of Defense was already, as you put it, manifestly aware of the drug's dangers.
Yes. And the article talks about discussions within DOD, other articles I've written, including with Jason Leopold, have talked about internal documents within DOT where they were, and other documents from the CDC talking about the dangers of mefloquine, the dangers of presumptive treatment of mefloquine, you know, in general. Specifically, the CDC said in 2003, do not use this drug for presumptive treatment except in the worst case, last analysis, you know, and DOD went ahead and did it.
The mefloquine SOP, standard operating procedure, was hidden from medical authorities at the Armed Forces Epidemiological Board.
Yes, that's what I was saying, and people can look at the link online and read the actual minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Of that discussion. Yeah.
And finally, you say there is the fact that no government agency will admit to advising use of the drug, even when a Guantanamo medical officer states they were involved. So the buck is being passed continuously, and no one accepts responsibility, except, I guess, Shimkus for signing the order.
Yeah, Shimkus, of course, there's a piece of paper with his name on it, so I guess he can't deny it, or he might have tried to pass the buck.
And from those as resolve clauses, you summarize, as a result of all of the above, it appears highly possible that the motive for the drug's use was to psychologically disorient and physically debilitate all or some portion of incoming prisoners.
Exactly. That's what it seems to have occurred. There is no other explanation for it. And I could have added to that list, by the way, not one medical authority has ever come forward to say epidemiological expert or tropical diseases expert or public health official has ever defended the use of what the DOD did with the presumptive mefloquine administration of drugs on the detainees. Not one to this day. And we called, we tried to contact. Okay, if you don't, you know, if you think we're wrong, just tell us. Tell us. We'll put, you know, on the record, or even off the record, nobody will say, yeah, this was a good idea. You're wrong. Except for Albert Shimkus.
Dr. Jeffrey Kay, thank you for joining us, and thanks for continuing this important investigation at truthout.org.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Did they ever think of just giving them fly swatters? Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.